Everyone, welcome to the Parkscope Unprofessional Podcast Hour. I keep saying this all the time, but man, I have not done this in a while. It feels like I do like 10 in a row, and then I don't do one for like a month, so... Jeez Louise. Oh, man. Again, for the past 2 years, everything has happened. Like, all of human civilization has occurred in all this time. And here we are, together again, since, I think, February 22nd was our last episode, or something like that. Oh boy. So, joining me on the podcast tonight is David Doubt. David, how are you doing?
Not too bad, all things considered.
Yeah, it's been a hot moment. You haven't been on for a while, so welcome back. You're the Three Timers Club.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Yes.
What, is it Five Timers when I get a jacket?
Yeah, exactly. We're playing by the Masterpiece Theater / SNL rules, so there you
Perfect.
Go.
Perfect.
Yeah, so you're getting there. Mm. So tonight, I have a wonderful Pizza Boy beer, Murren River. It's an IPA. Pizza Boy is one of probably my favorite brewery in Pennsylvania. Definitely
nice.
Up there. Good stuff, hard to find their stuff, but really good. And they make a lot of interesting things. Yeah, they used to be a pizza joint, and they made beer, and then like their beer became more popular than their pizza. So, there you go.
I'll have to check it out sometime.
Yeah, well, I can barely find it here, so good luck finding it in California, man.
Yeah, fair point.
It's in Enola, Pennsylvania, so there you go.
Well, if I'm ever out that way.
I mean, when you come out for the opening of Steel Curtain, the best ride
for, sure.
For the best ride in 2019, when that opens... yeah, come out to Steel Curtain and Steeler Country, everyone. That'll be opening soon. Legit, though, that looks like a good ride, but whatever. Let's spin the wheel. David, what do you want to talk about first?
Well, let's see. On the notes here, it looks like we've
got... We could also talk about HHN, I guess, too. I could put that on here, too, even though that didn't happen today. But...
Yeah, I mean, I'm good to start wherever you would like to. I mean, since you brought it up, let's just dive right in.
Halloween Horror Nights?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, well, we have no info. So. they've been meaning to announce Stranger Things for a while, is my understanding. Mm-hmm.
That feels like a given at this point.
That's sort of... It's kind of like the second year of American Horror Story. It's just like... Well, yeah, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's meaning to happen. I've heard it's supposed to happen. I just don't know when anymore. So Stranger Things. I mean, I think this would have been a great week to introduce it.
Yeah, it seems like it timed it with the trailer release.
Yeah, which, by the way, I found the Bubba O'Reilly cover they used for that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'll have to send it to you. But it's on. They just uploaded like the day it came out. So it's really
nice.
Good. Yeah, so, I mean, why not? It's probably the hottest property they've ever used in the event.
Oh my god! I mean, I still haven't done Orlando's event, but I imagine it was pretty similar out here. But it was just like, I mean, Horror Nights is usually pretty popular out here, but it was through the roof last year with, and I've got to attribute it mostly to Stranger Things, because that was the big draw last year. And I think that brought in, I mean, not just the regular haunt heads who go every year, but also I think it brought in a lot of people who normally don't go in for haunt so much, but are big fans of the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Orlando went all out for it, including doing the Stranger Things Day or whatever it was, the day that Will went missing, I think.
Yeah.
And they went right into that.
Yeah, I mean, just anecdotally, I don't have any numbers or anything to confirm this, but I mean, compared to previous years, Scary Farm over at Knott's was a lot... I mean, it wasn't... I don't think it was it caused problems for Knots, at least I hope not, but it was noticeably slower throughout the season than in previous years. Like, I think they only ever completely sold out one night last season, where typically there's, you know, at least three or four nights they completely sell out. And I've got to wonder if the popularity of Horror Nights last year siphoned people off from the other haunts out here in Southern California.
Maybe, yeah. I know Orlando sold out quite a few times, and I think their sellout's like 35,000 or 42,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's in addition to daytime guests. So, like, you're talking about a park that's pulling in more people than the Magic Kingdom in one day for,
right,
like, 2 months almost. And that's kind of insane.
Wow.
Like, that's what? So, yeah, that's kind of how Halloween Horror Nights works here. And that's why, on another angle, people are like, oh, well, aren't they going to bring it to the new park? I'm like, probably not, because I think the other two parks will need that attendance, like, leveling that Horror Nights will bring over the new park, which everyone wants to go to.
Yeah,
so
that
I think,
makes sense.
So I think that's why they won't do it, but, like...
At least not right away.
Yeah, I mean, like, I've always... Like, all the Universal... Like, the Universal parks in Orlando are over $10 million a year. So I think next year it's going to be up, but who knows what Thea says, you know? T and all that stuff, and...
Yeah.
But yeah, Horror Nights, we don't know what's going on quite yet, but the good news is, in a weird way, they've, like, really clamped down on rumors. You just don't hear the same stuff you did last year.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And that I like that, because, like, last year it felt like people are like, and what's next, and what's next, and what's next. And then when they figured it all out, they're like, oh, this sucks. You know, it's like, most people, I feel like, online really enjoy the speculation more than the actual event itself, in a way, it feels like. So,
I mean, just... I feel like that sort of is the trend of how things are going throughout. I mean, not just theme park fandom, but all fandoms. It seems like the build up and anticipation phase has become such a big thing, spurned on by marketing and internet discussion and everything else, that it's like, you know, we talk about the thing for months before it comes out, and then 2 weeks after the thing comes out, we've already moved on to the next thing. It's an interesting new development, which, you know, not totally sure how I feel about, but I guess that's the way of the world now.
Yeah, that's just kind of where we're at right now. Yeah, just, you know, speculation is news now, I guess, is the best way to put it. So that's Halloween Horror Nights. What do you want to pick next? Which one is interesting to you?
Well, I mean, on the subject of, you know, discussing things before they happen, let's just lean right in and get into Galaxy's Edge.
Okay, sure thing. So Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, last time we talked, we've had lots of news break.
Oh man, yeah.
We had the massive several day media event that happened. I know Jim Hill podcast, the Disney Dish did a great interview along with Ride This One. Also, Panzerino, I think Matthew Panzerino, was on the talk show with John Gruber. And that's normally like a technology/design podcast, but the end of that podcast was about Galaxy's Edge and theme parks.
Yeah.
And if any of you guys want to listen to something that's like very, I'm not into theme parks necessarily, but I'm interested in theme parks kind of talk, the talk show is a good thing to listen to, the last episode. Because they go into some different things that you normally don't hear, and it's just kind of interesting to hear another angle from it. So that's something that definitely check out. We went through a massive information dump, and then when I was in Disneyland, they announced the opening of Star Wars Galaxy's Edge will be, I believe, May 29th?
That sounds right, yeah. It's
the
31st, I think.
Okay,
because
so it's May 31st and then August 29th at Disney
World.
Right,
because it's 6 days later than I was expecting it would be. You know, everybody was surprised at how, I was definitely surprised by how early it's going to happen out in Florida. But for a long time, I thought they were going to try to get it on the Star Wars anniversary on May 25th. but missed it by 6 days, I guess. Close enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you hear anything on my mic, or are we all good?
Just you.
Just me? Okay, good, because I think my roommate is showering right now, and he's blaring music, so that's real cool.
Can't hear it on my end, but maybe,
Maybe
our audience will hear it and be shouting at us right now.
Yeah, Kevin, what am I going to do with you? Anyways, yeah, so I'm surprised it was announced that early, in a way, mainly because I was thinking definitely June and then, like, October. And even just a few months ago, people were still saying, oh, definitely December, if not 2020, for Disney World. And now it's August. Yeah. So,
I had been hearing that Florida was, like, at least 6 months behind Disneyland in terms of their progress. But they're getting it done, apparently, in 3 months after Disneyland's opens.
Yeah, and that's what's kind of crazy is, like, maybe – but that's the question is, like, what are they going to have done?
Yeah.
Because at this point, they're still very cagey of what this is going to offer.
Yeah, the wording on the parks blog post was very, very careful in what they said would be open. I mean, we know Millennium Falcon for sure. We know, like, the shops and restaurants for sure. But, like, the Smuggler's Run is definitely a no. And all the interactive, immersive, alternate reality game type stuff, that's a big question mark at this point. Like, I mean, will any of the character performers be out and about in the land? Will any of the roaming droids be online? Will that even be a thing anymore?
I don't. Yeah, who knows about that? I don't know. Anyway, continue. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and then even will the Play Disney Parks app functionality be ready to go for opening day? I mean, I assume if they can get, I assume Florida will probably have the Play Disney Parks functionality right out the gate because they'll have had, 3 months to get it working to get the app working and tested out in California. But who knows how long after opening that will appear in out here or if it will be a day one thing. Mm-hmm. There's still, for as much as we know, there's still a lot of questions on the table.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's, and as you brought up a good point, like, Is there going to be entertainment? I don't think, like, what I've heard is that there's not really entertainment in this place.
Yeah.
Besides, like, there's not any, like, stage shows like Diagon Alley or something like that. There's not any, or even Cars Land, you know, like, level shows in there. It just sounds like it's a lot of interactive stuff and some baseline things, but it's giving me these kind of weird, like, I'm really excited for Star Wars Galaxy's Edge. Like, I'm really, really excited. Like, Sean and I are planning to go. We're excited to go. We're skipping all sorts of stuff. We're going in October. But I'm also getting a lot of vibes. Like, I'm writing an article right now about Pandora.
Yeah.
World Avatar. And I'm looking at these articles talking about interactive plants and all this shit. And I'm like, oh, this is the same kind of talk they had for Pandora, like, for Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, but about Pandora and how...
Yeah.
It's giving me these vibes of, oh God, this isn't going to make it. It's going to get cut. And it's just going to be a bunch of buildings that you're going to walk around with some stuff inside, maybe. And then you have the two rides. And that's what's scary is like, oh God, this is sounding like things that get cut or at the end of something because they don't make it or people misinterpret. And that's what's scary is because this is a lot of money and there's a lot of hype here.
Yeah.
And that's my worry. And I'm not trying to be like, hey, it's going to suck, but like, because I'm excited for it. It's just, man, I'm just kind of anxious. Like, I'm hoping they actually hit this one out of the park. That'd be really good.
Oh, I mean, for sure. I mean, we all know Disney's history of promising things and then not quite delivering on them. I mean, most recent example probably is the however many months it took for the static, not animatronic Bing Bong figure to finally appear in Bing Bong Suite stuff out here at DCA.
Yes.
But what's interesting is I'm actually more worried about it out here than I am in Florida, which would typically be the opposite thing, because I think the interactive stuff will play more to locals than it will to tourists, at least at first. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that's going to save it out in Florida is the hotel, because if they want any kind of as long as the hotel is still moving forward and they want any kind of connectivity between the hotel and the land in terms of interactivity and story stuff, they're going to have to keep that online at least until the hotel gets off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Who knows what the hotel involves?
Right. I mean, that's even more of a question mark than anything about Galaxy's Edge at this point.
My understanding was that the hotel's been training for stuff recently. For a while, actually. So, yeah. That hotel is going to be weird. It's going to be really weird.
It's going to be interesting for sure. And I mean, a good friend of mine is, he doesn't work for Disney, but he is, he's involved in other...
Knowledgeable.
Right. He's knowledgeable about the industry in terms of like interactive experiences and alternate reality games. And he's leaked me some information that has not gone out to the wider populace about just some of the way Disney's talking about this hotel. And like one of the things that I've heard is they're very specifically avoiding like everybody's calling it the Star Wars Hotel because that's what like that's the easiest thing to call it. But internally, mm-hmm. like they're really avoiding that nomenclature. They're referring to it as the Star Wars multi-day experience.
Almost where, like what Jim Hill heard about the original name of Galaxy's Edge was about the hotel, which is kind of where like all rumors are. It's like you hear a rumor, but it's actually about something else or it's distorted just enough. Yeah.
Right. And so it'll be interesting to see, because I feel like it's going to be, because if people think of it as a traditional hotel, like, okay, this is my home base for where I'm going to be going to the parks and everything else. You know, I'm going to check into the Star Wars hotel.
Or it has a pool.
Right.
Or any of us, yeah.
Like that's not what they're aiming for in any way. From what I understand, it like the way to think of it more would be like in like an add-on to a typical vacation or even a replacement for a typical Disney vacation where it's like, okay, I go to the parks for 4 days and then I check in to do this weird 2 or 3 day Star Wars experience where I'm fully immersed in this world and I'm not really going to the parks because this is occupying all of my entertainment time and focus.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be interesting to see if they can pull it off and get people on board with that idea. I mean, there'll be hardcore dorks like me who will be out there the minute it opens, or at least try to be, because it sounds great. But beyond that initial wave, like it'll be interesting to see if they can get it to catch on with kind of a wider audience. I do think it's very smart that it sounds like, again, none of this is confirmed at this point. We're just all guessing based on rumors and inference and stuff like that. But it sounds like they're aiming for a pretty low max occupancy, which I think is smart because this is going to be a niche thing no matter what. And it makes more sense to have a lower capacity and keep it as close to fully occupied as possible versus, you know, having hundreds of rooms in this thing and leaving most of them empty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I have much also. There's a car going outside now, off outside now.
I can't hear that one.
What is going on with this apartment complex? I swear to God. I swear to God, everything. Okay, I'm going to check my car keys. Hold on a second.
Okay.
I swear, everything, this place is going crazy. Okay, it's not my car, so I just locked it. Okay, I have no idea what's going on here. Why tonight? Why is everything loud tonight? Jesus Christ, I don't know. I'm going to turn down the sensitivity on my microphone a little bit just in case. But yeah, there we go. Sensitivity down. There we go. But yeah, so we kind of touched on Project Delos a little bit, which is the interactive aspects through the Disney Parks app.
Right.
Sorry, you continue.
From what I understand, specifically, Delos is Like it's the interactivity in the park, but primarily it's the code name for the Star Wars Hotel or Star Wars multi-day experience. At least that's how it's been framed from the stuff that I've been leaked previously. But
okay, so that may be more of that angle, less of the Disney Play app.
Right.
Okay, got it. I think the interactive stuff looks great. Bonus, you don't need to buy something for it, like the wands.
Yeah.
Which is a plus. On the other hand, like, they need exponentially more things then to do because they don't need to buy anything. Because then everyone can do it.
Right. So again, we don't have a lot of information for how all of this is going to play out, but just based on some of the stuff, because a lot of the stuff that Disney has done in the past that people may or may not be familiar with have all kind of been play testing for Galaxy's Edge, even if they didn't know it was going to be implemented on Star Wars, they've had an idea to do something on this scale for a long time. And so they did stuff like The Optimist back in 2013 and Legends of Frontierland mm-hmm. back in 2014. And I think that Adventureland Trading Company thing happened that same year. And there's been multiple kind of test projects with in-park interactivity and immersive storytelling and character interactions, all of that going back almost half a decade now or more. And this is sort of the culmination of all of that. And so we don't have any details firmly on what this is going mm-hmm. to look like, but just looking at what stuff has been in the past, we can kind of take some guesses. My guess is that we're going to see something that is very much driven by sort of like a set schedule of, even if the schedule's not published, it'll be a set schedule of events that happens throughout the day where, you know, so in lieu of like traditional entertainment where, you know, this band plays on this stage at this time, at these seven times throughout the day or whatever, it'll feel a little bit more organic, but it will still be on a clock where, you know, every day at 3:30, there's a showdown between the Resistance and the First Order. And there's, you know, some big conflict that happens at that time. And, you know, the day-to-day storytelling that gets you to that point might change in the details. But my guess is that there will be kind of these fixed scenes that happen no matter what at certain times every day. And that'll mm-hmm. be in lieu of traditional entertainment options. And my guess is that with the app interactivity, it will kind of push you through the story to different things to kind of get you to those points. Back during Legends of Frontierland, a lot of that was accomplished through a telegraph system where the game masters off in their backstage area would send telegraphs out to the telegraph station and give players assignments or give information about certain characters, stuff like that, and be able to kind of move the pieces around from afar. And I'm
rebalance guessing, live almost in a way. Right, they're dungeon masters.
Oh, for sure. And 100%. That's exactly what they are. And I'm guessing that a lot of that will be handled through the app. And whether there will be, you know, I'm guessing at least in the very beginning, there will definitely be dungeon masters or the equivalent kind of overseeing the day-to-day operations and making sure everything's running smoothly. But I imagine later on there might be, it might be a little bit more automated where, you know, there can be a story set out and depending on what, where you're kind of poking and prodding at the story, it will automatically sort of give you hints and clues or redirects to move you where you need to go.
Mm-hmm.
The big question mark for me is whether this will be an ongoing persistent story or if it is going to be something that resets every day. 'Cause we've kind of seen two different versions of this idea but both take a radically, each one takes a radically different approach to how to do it. You've got Legends of Frontierland, that happened at Disneyland back in 2014, where it was an ongoing, persistent story, where you know you showed up and you created your character and you interacted with the different characters in the world and mm-hmm. played the game and whatever else, and then if you came back the next day or the next week or the next month, there was an apparatus for the game to remember who you were and your actions. And it was all kind of overseen by these game masters, and there was an element of persistence to it that would keep you coming back and reward people for coming back.
Yeah.
The problem of that approach, though, was it was completely unsustainable. It was great. I had a blast, and everyone I knew had a blast. But like, it became very clear in retrospect that they were they had never anticipated the way certain of us, myself included, would get into it, and they were kind of flying by the seat of their pants, making it up as they went.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was great. It felt great, and it was a lot of fun to sort of have this story tailor made to me, basically, because they would just improv and riff and move the story forward based on the specific directions that I and other players were interested in poking at. But that's not sustainable for a long time on a long scale, mm-hmm. or on a large scale. So the opposite of that kind of is the Ghost Town Alive game that they've had at Knott's Berry Farm the past few years, where it's very similar to Legends of Frontierland in a lot of ways in terms of you know, the Western setting and the character interactions and stuff happening throughout the day. But what makes a difference is it's not a persistent storyline. It there's a hard reset every day where it's almost like a Groundhog's Day thing where you you know,
great way to put it. Yes.
Yeah, you show up one day and the story plays out, and you come back the next day, none of the characters will act like they remember you. The story plays out pretty much exactly the same way. Little details might change,
like a Broadway show almost, in a way.
Right. Or like Sleep No More or some other kind of immersive theater experience. In fact, talking to one of the game's lead writers, like he really resisted the inclination to categorize it as a game at all. He wanted it to be seen more as an immersive theater experience, like Sleep No More or other mm-hmm. Similar experiences. So it'll be interesting to see what direction Disney goes with that, because for Galaxy's Edge, because the total free form, wide open nature of Legends of Frontierland was great and a lot of fun, but it won't work for what they're trying to do. It barely worked for what they did back in 2014.
Let alone Star Wars.
Right. I mean, just the scale of that is going to be massive, and the number of people playing, but I hope they find some way to have some level of persistence that rewards people coming back and rewards repeat players mm-hmm. beyond what Ghost Town Alive has, which, you know, Ghost Town Alive is also very fun, but it's because of the resetting nature of it. It's one of those things where you do it once and you kind of like, okay, I've seen most of it. There's not the same compulsion to go back and dive in again and again and again. So I'm hoping they're able to strike some balance between those two, where it's welcoming to new players, and you know, people who are visiting from out of town and can only do it for a day feel like they get a full satisfying experience. But if you are lucky enough to have an annual pass or be a regular visitor or whatever else, there'll be something to reward that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So actually, do you have any thoughts, any other thoughts about Star Wars Galaxy's Edge from that angle? I think we've kind of, I mean, I'm okay with them opening it in phases, depending on what those phases entail, and we don't know enough yet. Cause I think this would be a good way to segue into Nevermore.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point, because, you know, like you said, as long as there's enough to do on opening day that it feels satisfying, you know, that's going to be great. And even if all of the interactive stuff isn't online and Rise of the Resistance isn't online, obviously, if the, you know, if Millennium Falcon is really good and the experience of walking through the land and everything feels like it, as long as it feels good, that will be satisfying. And as long as the other stuff does actually come later and it's not in infamous Disney phase two, that never happens. That'll be fine. But you look at something like Evermore and you, mm-hmm. you do kind of see the dangers of opening something before it's really finished or finished at all.
Yes, definitely.
So for people who are not familiar, Evermore is a theme park, question mark.
It's a theme park. Let's just say it's a theme park. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very, very small kind of boutique theme park that opened last fall in just outside of Salt Lake City, Utah, just like 40 minutes south. And it's a theme park that does not have any rides or attractions in the traditional sense. It's a park that is in theory entirely dedicated to this idea of immersive storytelling and interactive play that we've been talking about with things like Galaxy's Edge and Legends of Frontierland and all this other stuff, which for a certain audience sounds like a dream come true. I mean, there's people like myself and Hasten Zylstra and Nick mm-hmm. Tierce who are really into this kind of thing, and to have a whole park that like that's the draw, that's the appeal, that sounds like everything we've kind of always wanted. And so we, a group of us, took a road trip out there for the grand opening last fall. But as we were making preparations to get out there, there were a few red flags, let's say. For one, the grand opening that we had bought tickets to at some point magically turned into a pre-opening preview event.
Weird.
And then at some point they asked for, I think this is actually like the morning of the day we started the trip out there, because we drove, and it's about a 12-hour drive between LA and Salt Lake. And so the morning we set out to drive, we get this email that says, if you're coming from out of town for this, please let us know right away. And we're like, oh, no, this is
bad. Oh, no. Yeah.
So it was not quite as bad as we were fearing. Like we were worried that it was just going to be a case of it's not done, don't come, please go away. And it wasn't that. What it was, they said, hey, this thing is not going to be ready in the way we hoped it would be. So we're going to, because you are taking the time and expense to travel out here for this, we're going to refund the price of your tickets, which was a nice gesture.
Yes, but also that's very nice for them to do that.
Right. So we finally do get out there with our expectations kind of thoroughly out of whack. And the best thing I can say about Evermore is that it showed a ton of potential. Like walking through it, you could tell that this could be something really special at some point, but it was not at that point. It was, to say it was even half finished would be generous. There were still buildings that were, about half the buildings that were constructed were, you know, still just wood framing and without any finishing details or interiors or anything like that. And then there was a big section of the park, again, a small park, but, you know, probably 20 to 30% of the park that was just not done at all. No buildings had been constructed. No landscaping had been done. It was just, you know, still waiting to go up. None of the interactive stuff was ready to go. They had performers and characters out there to kind of give the impression of what this might be like at some point, but it very quickly proved to all be dead ends. Like there was no story happening that night. Mm-hmm. There were no quests to go on. No details to uncover. It was just a few the few actors they had roped in doing their best to paper over the kind of gaping holes in the experience. And that was definitely a bummer. But I came away from it writing, and the piece I wrote about it for No Proscenium was, in spite of everything, fairly positive and optimistic. Because again, I think there is huge amounts of potential in the idea, and as long as they could get it finished and get it working the way it was meant to, that would be great. But unfortunately, it seems like they kind of haven't, at least not yet. Again, we went out there before it was technically open back in early September, I think it was. Mm-hmm. So several months have passed, and the park is a lot further along than it was. We have not been back out there since, but there's, just from pictures posted online, and there's like a Facebook group of fans out there that regularly posts updates, and one guy has like a drone that he periodically flies over the thing and takes drone footage. So it's the park itself physically has come a long way since then. It's still not totally done, but it's much closer to being done than it was back in September, which, is to be expected for however many months of work, even with the limited amounts of work they can do over the snowy winter season in Utah. But in terms of the interactive stuff and the immersive storytelling, which is, because this is a park that doesn't have rides or attraction, that is the park's attraction. It sounds like they're still kind of floundering a little bit. It sounds like I've got to constantly put the disclaimer here that I have not seen this in person for myself since September, but just looking at stuff from what fans have posted on the Facebook group and their own social media and stuff like that, it seems like a lot of the interactive storytelling is kind of fly by the seat of their pants, and there's not a lot of depth to the experience. It's kind of amounts to like empty scavenger hunts where it's okay. Like, here, go to this thing and get this prize and hooray, you're done. You did the thing for the day. Come back again sometime soon. I think, I don't even know if I want to say this on the air because I'm not 100.
Then don't say it. It's okay. Yeah, you don't need to.
Probably not, because I remember hearing this, but I'm not 100% sure about it, so I'm just not going to put it out there if it's not true. We can talk off the air. But it just, for all the potential this place has, it seems like they have not even begun to mine that potential yet, and that's frustrating. And at some point, I would like to get back out there after, mm-hmm. at least the construction is fully finished and just see what it looks like after the fact. But I hope they either the creative team they has kind of really steps up their game and lives up to the promise that it always had, or they, get a new creative team that can deliver on the promise that they had talked about from the beginning. Because and this was not just us projecting onto it. This was stuff they had said all along. Like, this is going to be, they had said it was going to be this hugely immersive experience and this game changer in the industry. And they had hyped it up so much. And for it to not just fall short of the hype, but to kind of not even be in the same reality of what they're saying was disappointing.
Yeah. It kind of sounds like a bunch of software people who are not used to doing hardware.
Yeah, well, I mean,
that if that kind of makes sense.
Oh, for sure, and that's possibly literally correct, because yeah. It's the same. The guy who's kind of running the show. Void.
Void. Okay. Yeah. Okay,
yeah. He was one of the co-founders of The Void, and he left The Void to embark on this adventure.
yes, this adventure.
Yeah. And I wish them all the best. I hope they can figure out some way to make it work. And, to their credit, it seems like they've found a pretty loyal audience out in Utah that, despite some of the park's failings and the fact that it's you know, still not completely done. It seems like there are people out here there who are eating it up and are loving it and coming back every week and every month and whatever else.
Damn trying to go out there and support it too.
Yeah, yeah.
Being an independent entertainment thing and such a scope that we've never seen before in decades, I would say.
I mean, the most tragic version of it to me would be if they can never figure out how to make it work and it just closes and it just becomes this abandoned experiment. That would be devastating. And I don't want to see that happen to that park, because I do think it has a ton of potential. And I would hope that once all the construction's done, they can find a way to, you know, really dig down and live up to the promise that they had made for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, so thank you for your Evermore experience, because that was something I've always was interested in, and I saw a bunch of people go to, and was just very interested to see what's happening with it. And I just wanted your opinion on it, because I mean, I need boots on the ground, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess for any listeners out there, if you live in Utah, and that's an easy trip for you to make, like, I'd totally recommend going out there, just checking it out. It's it's not very expensive, and it's what's there is interesting and kind of fun for a day trip. Like, it's worth checking out if you're interested in theme parks and theme design and stuff like that, and you're close by. If you are not in Utah, I'd say maybe wait a little bit. It's not worth making a trip out there just for that. But hey, maybe someday.
And plus, I think that's the best thing we can say is, like, maybe someday. God, please. Yeah. Maybe someday. So I apologize, but like, I just had this, man, in Pittsburgh, we're getting spring crazy. So I'm now way congested, and I just had like a massive like 5-minute sneezing fit. So I have like a box of tissues next to me. My ears have been popping all day, by the way, because the pressure's been changing. So this is what my body does now.
That's fun.
Yeah. So
I was going through that a couple weeks ago, so I sympathize.
Yeah. So now I'm like, oh no, I know what's going on right now. So if I fade out every once in a while, it's because I am in a 2-minute sneezing fit and just tossing tissues on my floor.
Fair enough.
This is where I am in life. So we have two more topics for tonight, David. What do you want to talk about next?
Well, let's, I guess we should address some of the, big news, which is, you know, the Fox and Disney merger that at least at the time of, our recording just barely happened.
A day ago. And,
it has, I mean, huge implications on not just the theme park industry, but the movie industry and kind of like just
everything. No, they have Atlanta on their main site. Like, Atlanta, like Childish Gambino is on the main website of the Walt Disney Company now.
Right.
It's just, this is like, something crazy.
Disney is now just this absurdly huge media empire that has fingers in everything, and it's deeply unsettling. But let's, I guess, dig into the more specific theme park ramifications of it and try to unpack what we can there.
Yeah. So I think on the grand aspects of everything, the first question that I've seen pop up is like, okay, so what's Disney going to do with Simpsons?
Right.
And I think nothing, because what the hell are they going to do with it? Seriously, if you sit down and think about it, what the hell are they going to do with the Simpsons in any amusement park that they own? Nothing.
Yeah, it doesn't make any, it fundamentally doesn't make any sense for them to put. The Simpsons would not fit in any of the current Disney parks, and it would, and frankly, it doesn't fit with the branding and the type of experience Disney has curated for those parks. It would stick out like a huge sore thumb, where it does fit in very well with the type of experience that Universal has curated. And so I think the smartest thing for Disney to do at this point is just let Universal have it, collect the licensing fees and the merchandising money, and just not do a damn thing about it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where it's at too. Like, and not just that, but like Bob's Burgers, Family Guy,
right?
That shit ain't gonna show up in an amusement park. I mean,
yeah,
that's not gonna. You're not gonna see ABC Commissary become Bob's Burgers or something like that. Watch it happen in a year from now because I said it. but it's the kind of thing where you're just not going to see it happen.
Yeah.
And like I saw someone, I don't know, ironically go say it, basically being like, well, how's Disney going to, leverage The Simpsons to get Marvel back from Universal in Orlando? And my response is basically LOL, because one of those has a finite contract and one of them doesn't. Right. And one is a multi-billion dollar property and the other one, they'd be like, okay, yeah, sure, whatever. We'll get rid of the ride we've been looking to get rid of anyways. So peace out.
That's the thing. It's the Simpsons is great and it remains an enduring fixture of pop culture, but it's a property whose glory days are well behind it. And kind of, one of these days the show's going to end. I mean, who knows when that's going to happen, whether it takes Dan Castellaneta passing away or one of the other like huge members of the cast passing away and they're not going to want to recast the role. But at some point, The Simpsons will end. It's gone on for a very long time, and it probably won't end anytime soon, but someday it will. And it would not make sense for Universal to give up Marvel to save The Simpsons. That's not a winning deal for them.
Yeah, for Universal. For Disney, that's like, yeah, sure, let's do it. But also on the other angle, like Disney doesn't want to spend the money to get those contracts back for Spider-Man, Hulk,
right,
and these characters when they already have, Guardians of the Galaxy, Doctor Strange, and several of those characters just ready to go.
Right.
That's something that they've been showing a willingness to, actually hash out some information with Universal, and then just go with it. I've not been the first person to hear something about Doctor Strange going into Epcot, doesn't make sense. It's dumb as fuck, but, let's be honest, it's Imagineering right now, and they don't care, so...
Yeah, but. No, fair point. I mean, and, at this point, a lot of the principal members of the Avengers are going to be out of the picture after April. I mean, we're probably not going to see much of Iron Man anymore, or Cap, or... I mean, maybe we'll still see more of Thor and Hulk, but, the Marvel stuff that Disney is interested in is kind of moving beyond what Universal has to play with. I mean, now Disney's getting back the X-Men and Fantastic Four and stuff like that. But I don't see them ponying up huge sums of money to try to get those theme park rights back. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
It really has never made sense. And that's kind of the thing. It's, whenever I hear things about Disney getting theme park rights back for Marvel, that's kind of my dog whistle of, you are not someone I should listen to.
Oh, for sure.
It's just very much someone that's not very serious into a discussion, because either they don't care what's going on, and clearly Disney can do better, and screw The Amazing Adventures of Spider-Man and that whole land, and... clearly Disney can do better, or it doesn't matter. I just want Disney to have it. So it's just sort of like, okay, I can't have a discussion with you. You're just so out there, so I can't do that.
Right. I understand where the people are coming from who just want, who are just Disney loyalists and want all the Disney eggs in one basket, and to have it be neat and tidy like that. I disagree, but I
every egg that, ever created in one basket.
Right. Right. But what I don't understand is the people who are like, oh, Disney could do so much better with it. And it's like, have you guys actually seen what Disney's done so far and is planning to do with Marvel stuff at the parks where they can actually use it? It's like they're not putting their best foot forward necessarily. I mean, Mission Breakout is fun, but it's a slapdash overlay of a different attraction. And yeah. I mean, every Marvel attraction so far has been in overlay of an existing ride. And, you know, some of them have been, you know, better than others, but they're not. You look at what Disney's doing with Star Wars and the ambition of that and the ground that they're trying to break with that and really pushing what theme parks can be, or at least trying to, in a new direction. And then to go from that to what they're doing with Marvel and what they're planning to do with Marvel, it's just a huge whiplash in ambition, where you've got like the most ambitious thing next to something that's barely ambitious at all.
Mm-hmm. The Iron Man ride in Hong Kong is a new ride, but it's also just Star Tours.
Yeah.
Like,
right. And then the Ant-Man ride is literally
repurposing Buzz Lightyear.
Right. And then out here, I mean, we got a little bit more information on the Spider-Man ride that's coming to California Adventure today. And I mean, for all intents and purposes, it sounds like it's going to be a repurposed version of the ride mechanic from Toy Story Midway Mania. It's like they're not doing anything new with it, which is extremely frustrating. And what's also frustrating is just the way that it doesn't seem like Disney really understands the right way to use these characters. Whenever I say this, people point to examples of where I'm wrong and where Spider-Man has been an Avenger in the past. I mean, at this point, most people recognize that Tony Stark technically made Spider-Man an Avenger in Infinity War, but traditionally, Spider-Man has never worked as an Avenger. That's not what the character is. That's not the best role that the character fills, and it's kind of been this constant tension with Marvel, because you have Spider-Man, who in the real world is their most popular character, has always been their most popular character, but in the fictional world is kind of a third or fourth string superhero. He's not one of the big dogs, and in fact his power set only makes sense in New York City. Like, his power set relies on a huge but also incredibly compact urban environment to work. Like, if you take him somewhere where there's not huge skyscrapers all mushed right next to each other, like, he's just a regular guy like you and me who has maybe faster reflexes. And just beyond the power set, though, who Peter Parker is as a character, where he's kind of constantly on the outs and has trouble making connections and maintaining connections with people, and just his whole suite of problems, it doesn't make sense for him to be an Avenger. And it's those stories have never worked super well. And so by Disney choosing to make the Marvel Land in California Adventure a West Coast Avengers campus, they've kind of put themselves back in that same box where it's like, oh, well, we want to have a Spider-Man ride, but Spider-Man isn't really an Avenger, so how do we make this work? And the solution they've come up with is, oh, well, Tony Stark has created this web initiative where he's developing technology to bring in new recruits and stuff like that. And it's a weird...
It never got the character. That's not the character.
Right. Right, and it's trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, and it's frustrating, because the right way to do a Marvel themed land is to do New York City. Marvel has always been inextricably linked to New York City, and the there's so much life and vibrance and detail you could bring from a recreation of New York City, and you could have all of the characters together, but also in environments that suit them. You can have everything from the Avengers Tower to, you know, little corner bodegas. Like, it's, you can fit the entirety of who these characters are into this one space, which is what they've always done in the comics, and it's always worked. But again, the ambition is not that high. They don't want to create this huge, hugely detailed, hugely immersive land. They want to.
It'd be really awkward to build New York City in California Adventure.
Yeah, I mean,
there's when it comes to that.
But at this point, like, it's California Adventure in name only. We're kind of beyond. We've already moved past the California theming of the park in a lot of ways, and there are ways you could probably pay lip service to it just as well as they've done for any of the other paying lip service in the park, like Cars Land and Soarin' Over the World and whatever else that doesn't really fit. But it's like, at this point, Disney is less interested in the theme of parks than they are in, okay, we have this thing that we want to put in a park. What park needs something right now? And so Disneyland just got Galaxy's Edge. California needs to get Marvel. It's, you know, they're alternating back and forth rather than tailoring stuff to fit the theme of individual parks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a whole complicated mess, to say the least.
Yeah. But it's just, and again, I hope it's good. I hope it's fun. It probably will be pretty fun. I mean, that's like, even that, I think, is the insidious secret to Disney's success right now. Even the stuff that's not great is pretty fun. Like, it's good enough. It's good enough that people go and they have a good time, and they don't feel like they are wasting their time or their money on it, which is important, because if people start to feel that way, then Disney's got a huge problem with how much their tickets cost. Mm-hmm. But it lacks ambition, and I would like to see, and there's no reason for Disney to not be ambitious with the amount of money and the number of properties and whatever else they have. Like, they should be, like, every single thing they do should be as ambitious as Galaxy's Edge, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Spooderman at DCA. yeah, Midway Mania. Anyway, we got one last topic to talk about tonight. I'll head this one off a little bit differently. So, for a little bit of while, there's only been one version of Muppet Vision 3D. Then there was one in California Adventure, and that one closed. And recently, they've been kind of chipping away slowly but surely at Muppet Vision 3D. They changed the marquee sign. They changed the fountain out front. Just recently, they repainted some of the areas in the back that were a little more character-driven, I would say. Is that a good way to put that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of came down to then, well, you know, what about this ride? Like, what can we preserve of this attraction? And then that's when we start thinking in a larger sense, well, this is the last thing that, like, Jim Henson did.
Yeah.
Like, this is not some sort of, you know, just normal attraction that's going to close, but this is, like, more of a larger context of American history or American culture that is going to be shut down. And unlike, like, a last film or a last album or a last concert from someone, this is a larger experience than just that. And the interesting question that I've been asking for a while and thinking about for quite a while, actually, is attraction preservation. This idea of, you know, as themed attractions become more prevalent in society and as bigger figures participate in them, mm-hmm. you know, like, what's the role of these companies beyond being like, hey, we got something cool for you for the next 6 months? Like, is there anything to actually preserve? Do they have a responsibility? Does someone else should do it? I mean, I don't know, because, like, we're also looking at things like, you know, Captain EO, even minus the Michael Jackson controversies that have happened and still exist and are very real. Like,
yeah,
this is still pop culture in a way from that time frame.
Right, and you've also got the involvement of George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola and all these other, you know, major players in American art and pop culture from that era. And, you know, Michael Jackson was almost certainly a deeply troubled person who hurt people in deeply profound ways. But the should all of that art that he made just vanish for all time? And it's a tricky, complicated conversation to have. And what makes it more tricky is when part of that art is a show that was only ever designed to exist in a few specific places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, even beyond Michael Jackson, you've got, I mean, we're talking about Jim Henson, who is one of the most significant creative figures in of the 20th century. I mean, like, imagine if the Beatles' last album just vanished one day. Like, it's like, oh, well, we're done with this one now. Let it be. You can't listen to that one anymore. I'm trying to think of other pertinent examples, but you get the idea. It's like, it's a significant milestone in Jim Henson's career.
It would be like if I Love Lucy only existed as audio plays.
Right.
That kind of level of something where this something is missing, because to pull back a little bit, you know, like, it's not just like Jim Henson was really important, because he was really fucking important, because like the Muppet Show was like the first Western show shown in the Soviet bloc.
Yeah.
like this is actually huge. Like, this is big. This is something I think people forget now. It's just like, oh, it's just the Muppets. No, it's not. That's really big.
I think some people might balk at my comparison between the Muppets and the Beatles, but the Muppets were a huge player in pop culture of the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s. I mean,
and like, counterculture too.
Right. I mean, they like. They guest starred on every show, and everyone guest starred on their show. They were ubiquitous. Everybody knew the Muppets, and everybody loved the Muppets. And it's a hugely important part of our collective culture. And this is, I mean, not only is it Jim Henson, the final film Jim Henson worked on and directed, but it's also just a really stinking good Muppets film. I mean, it's one of the best things I think that Jim Henson personally directed, and it's among the better examples of Muppets in general. Like, if I was to introduce somebody to the Muppets who had never had any prior exposure to them, like, Muppet Vision 3D is kind of the thing I would want to go to, because it kind of has everything that's great about the Muppets in one concentrated experience. And to lose that would be just a monumental loss. And I think we should step back and clarify. We don't know that Muppet Vision is going anywhere, where there's currently no indication that it's going anywhere. As Joe mentioned, Disney's kind of been chipping away at the Muppet placemaking around the show in Hollywood studios, and that's disconcerting, but we don't know for sure that anything's going to happen to it anytime soon. Mm-hmm. But it's if something were to happen to it, it would be a tremendous loss, and it's a loss that would not be easy to replace. I mean, we talked about stuff like Captain EO, and Captain EO, if Disney was so inclined, which they absolutely will not be in light of the Finding Neverland documentary and everything else, and at least not anytime soon. That's not going to see the light of day. But if Disney were so inclined, they could release that on Blu-ray or streaming or whatever other home media platform, and it would be a fairly complete experience. The in-theater effects back when they first made the show were kind of an afterthought, and even those were not preserved when it came back for Captain mm-hmm. EO tribute. They just repurposed the Honey, I Shrunk the Audience effects, which were not part of the original show. So the film itself is upwards of 98% of the experience, and that is relatively easy to preserve. You can scan the film prints, which I'm sure Disney already has high resolution scans of, and store those and distribute them, and that's all easy. What makes Muppet Vision complicated is, like, if
everything else.
Yeah, I mean, if we're being generous, the film aspect of that show is like maybe 60% of the experience, and then you've got the in-theater effects, and you've got audio animatronic Muppets in front of you and to your sides and behind you.
Live
and
actors. Got
live actors and everything else. I mean, there's never a point in that show where there's not something else to look at besides the screen. Even if it's mm-hmm. just the idle motions of the animatronic Muppets in the balconies or the penguins in the orchestra, like there's always something happening not on screen. And if you only preserve the film aspect of it, you're losing everything else that surrounds it. And a lot of some of the jokes won't land, and some of the story beats won't play. And it becomes a fundamentally different thing at that point. Mm-hmm. So if Disney does not want to keep it in the parks anymore, how do you keep that around? How do you preserve that piece of culture and art and history? I mean, and I think the only way you can really do it is in a museum setting. Like, you would need somewhere that would be willing to dedicate the space to have a permanent installation of it. So something like the Museum of the Moving Image or different art or cinema museums throughout the world. And have Disney either donate or be willing to license out to one of these institutions. But then you get into all the sticky issues of, well, who's going to pay for it and who's going to maintain it and everything else. And it becomes a very complicated issue.
Well, I was thinking VR. Like, this could be a good instance where a VR experience could actually work, where you see, you know, the courtyard, you could see the pre-show, like you could have well done recreations of these things along with, you know, the actual image in 3D along with everything around you. And yeah. I think another thing you missed was, like, hey, being in, you know, Hollywood Studios was an important part of this experience because, hey, at the end of the show, they blow out the back wall, and that's where you're supposed to walk around at the end of the show, and that's where they had that blown out wall. So,
no, for sure. I mean, even when it was in California Adventure, like that aspect of it was like the show was great, and I loved having it out here and being able to see it all the time, and I wish it was still out here. But yeah, that aspect of the show was a little bit of a disconnect because it's like, oh, well, you know, the end of the show, you're seeing out the back wall of the theater into Hollywood Studios, and you walk out the theater and you're in California Adventure. And so it's, you know, every piece that is removed from every step that it's removed from the original experience and the original intent is diminishing the experience in some small way. And I think the same is true for VR, and that, like, realistically, that's probably the best we're ever going to get. I mean, Muppet Vision is an easier aspect to pick up and move somewhere else than something like, say, Horizons or these massive sprawling audio animatronic attractions. Like, I mean, even if you could find somewhere with the space to put all that, like, just paying for it and maintaining it and keeping it running and everything else, like it's logistically almost impossible. Muppet Vision is conceivable, but also hugely unlikely that would ever happen. And so VR becomes probably the best option. And I think as VR technology improves in the ability to capture more and more resolution and more lifelike details, it could be a pretty good approximation of what was there. But I don't think we're quite there yet. And that makes it tricky because it's like, on one hand, it scratches that itch, but it also, you're conscious the entire time of, oh, well, this really isn't that thing. It's just a kind of approximation of it. It's almost like listening to the cast album of a Broadway show like that.
Yeah,
that's great. And it can be a lot of fun, and it can sort of scratch that itch of, oh, I'm getting to, you know, sing along with my favorite songs and get the experience of the story. But it's different from seeing it in person and
with the audience, like, with the effects, with the band, with, I mean, how, right. I mean, how much else do we have to keep going? You know, you get the idea, like the stage and the stage hands and the accidental, like, things that happen every day and, you know, right. All that stuff.
And that's what makes theme park attractions so interesting and unique, because it's somewhere between a movie, which is a fixed experience, and live theater, which is a completely organic, non-fixed experience, because you have this thing that, you know, you basically press play on and it runs the same way every time. You know, Pirates of the Caribbean, as long as everything is working right, will do the same things no matter how many times you go through it. But you can't easily, but you also can't put Pirates of the Caribbean on a disc. Like it's this weird middle ground.
Yeah, and that's a good point too. Like, you just can't film it and then watch it again. Like, sorry, Martin, we just can't, like, relive these rides.
Yeah.
In the same way that you can in real life.
Right. And that makes it much closer to live theater because, yeah, you can film, a single, theatrical performance, but you're losing that, immersive quality to it. You're losing that interplay with the audience and the performers. You're losing the subtle differences in performance and improvisation that happens night to night. But then, you know, a play can be so every instance of a play is this ephemeral thing that only exists once, but you can put on a play an infinite number of times, even if it's different cast members or different choreographers or whatever else. Like, you know, how many years has Phantom of the Opera been running on Broadway now? And
we'll ask Lindsay Ellis, she'll know.
Right. and so it's like each individual performance is this ephemeral thing, but you can duplicate it to some extent with different actors and different locations and as many times as you could want. You can put the same show in every theater in the world pretty easily, where you can't do that with a theme park attraction. It's this fixed experience that is only designed to exist in, like, at most, like, five or six places in the world. And outside of there, there's not really any good solutions to it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's the most interesting. Like, I don't think we have an answer to it, and I don't think anyone can at this point.
Right.
But it's worth a discussion because I don't think that it's being discussed at all. Because
right.
theme park attractions are being viewed, rightfully or wrongfully, as just ephemera of pop culture at this point.
Right.
Where it's not the last thing Jim Henson did. It's viewing it as the Harry Potter ride, you know? So.
Right. And like, I think, and I think there's some stuff that, you know, like, ideally everything would be preserved. Like, I think that ideally every movie would be available for consumption and every book would be available for consumption and whatever else. But, like, realistically, not everything gets preserved. I mean, there are movies that were on VHS that never made it to DVD, and movies on DVD that never made it to Blu-ray, and movies that have never been transferred to a home video format at all, because just...
Or movies completely lost.
Right. And a lot of those, I mean, the lost movies are different because that was back in an era where film preservation was not... Nobody had the foresight to do that. But, like, a lot of stuff that has never made it to home video is stuff that too few people gave a shit about to care to transfer it to a home video platform. And the same is probably true for theme parks. Like, you know, do we really need a preservation of that Stitch show that lasted for all of 5 minutes at Magic Kingdom? I mean, ideally, yes. And people have footage of it that's up on YouTube and stuff like that. But is, like, do we need a special installation to preserve that? No, probably not.
But should we have a special installation for Adventures Through Inner Space? Should we have something for, like, even something that's, like, when you look back at historical context, like, what about, you know, Adventures Through Nature's Wonderland? What about, going even crazier, like, okay, well, what about that really shitty knockoff version of the Jungle Cruise that Narnia Dreamland had?
Right, right. and there's all these... You get into all these interesting shades of gray and differences of opinion. And I wonder if the, like, some kind of institution or governing body like the Library of Congress shouldn't start inducting themed attractions as being culturally or historically significant, which, like, they do with films and books and television and whatever else. I mean, and if that wouldn't have some incentive for those rides or those attractions to be better preserved in some way, I mean, it doesn't guarantee preservation. I mean, you look at something like Star Wars, which is in the Library of Congress, but George Lucas declined to submit a copy of the original cut of the movie. He said, I'll give you the special edition in Library of Congress. It's like, no thanks, we want the original. And George Lucas is like, too bad. So it's on the list, but they don't actually have a copy of that one. So, like, it's not...
Yeah.
So, you know, Disney or Universal or whoever else should not have to physically submit a copy to the Library of Congress, which would be obviously impractical, if not impossible to do, but having a body recognize certain important works like that might give them incentive to say, maybe we should treat this a little bit more seriously and a little bit more carefully, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting question. And I think there are, like, you look at something like Pirates of the Caribbean, which, you know, is just a theme park, right? But it's also a major fixture of American, especially, but also worldwide popular culture. Everybody knows Pirates of the Caribbean. Everybody knows Yo Ho Yo Ho, A Pirate's Life for Me. It's, in, for better or for worse, inspired a series of $5 billion movies. even beyond the official Pirates of the Caribbean movies, it has, back in the day, it sort of sparked a brief, albeit, but a small resurgence in the popularity of pirate films, which were kind of on their way out at that point.
Completely out.
Right. But after Pirates of the Caribbean opened, it's like, maybe pirates are back in a little bit. And, you know, that didn't last long, but it had an effect on the culture beyond the walls of Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, do we... Something that is as significant as that, there should be some mechanism to recognize that and preserve that, and there just isn't anything in place at this point to do that.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I can cover any more. But I think we've touched a lot on this.
Yeah, so. I mean, there's only so much to say because there's only so much that we can do at this point, and I think, like you said, VR is probably the best we're going to get at this point, but it'll be interesting to see as technology develops and as our relationship with these things changes, how that conversation progresses in the future.
Yeah, and by VR, I don't even mean filming in VR. I mean recreating
Yeah.
completely everything in VR. Like,
recreate, like, do Pixar having Sweetums come out with the, like, with the light, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, Bonnie, you know, everything, like, and then have the film recreated in 3D in the, you know, in the headset. Like, that's an option. Like, you don't have yeah. to just film it. You could recreate some of this in VR. And what's interesting is Disney did say, hey, relive old attractions, you know, as in a limited time scale, like maybe 8 years ago, 9 years ago, and nothing mm-hmm. came of it. So what's going on? Like that's that thing. Like,
okay. I do have one more thing to say on the topic.
Okay.
One super easy bit of preservation of old theme park attractions. Hey, Disney, put the legacy audio tracks as selectable options in Spaceship Earth. Get at me.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah. On your little onboard touchscreen in your car, after you select your language preference, there should be an option to listen to Dame Judi Dench or Jeremy Irons or Walter Cronkite. And just because, I mean, the rest of the ride's basically the same. And
yeah.
So you change the audio track and suddenly, hey, we're back to the version of it that existed back in 82 or in 94 or whatever else.
Or why isn't Tomorrow's Child on iTunes? Or why isn't all this, you know, Barry Braverman music on iTunes? Like, why is everything not available?
So. Yeah, I do wonder at a certain point with stuff like virtual reality and augmented reality and stuff like that, if we're not going to see experiences in the future where it's like, here's this augmented reality headset where you can go and experience ride Pirates of the Caribbean and experience the original version of Pirates of the Caribbean through augmented reality. I wonder if we're not going to see something like that exist eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what else to say. For real now. So, David, where can all this fantastic listeners, all this, you know, this one, the one person.
This one, yeah.
Yeah, this you. One person. You.
We're talking to you.
We're talking to you. We're thinking
you
talking
in your
to
car,
all. Yeah.
Or doing your dishes or whatever else. Whatever you're doing right now, we're talking to you specifically.
We think we're talking about everyone around you, but we're just talking to you. to continue the Muppet Vision 4D references. Mm-hmm. David, where can everyone find you at?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at David M. Doubt. Doubt is spelled D-A-U-T. Or you can find me on my website where I do film criticism and analysis and stupid 22-part series breaking down the timeline of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies.
Yeah.
all of that you can find at my website, which is davidmdoubt.com.
Fantastic. You can find me at Parkscope Joe. You can find all of us at Parkscope and Parkscope.net. Yeah, go rate, review us, leave terrible reviews, because I guess that's what people do. I don't know. I don't know what else to say. But again, thank you, David, for joining us tonight. It's
Absolutely.
Been a fantastic discussion. We're talking about stuff that I just don't think gets discussed at all.
Oh, like, for sure.
This is stuff that we just don't hear about, so it's nice to talk about it with someone because, man, we gotta talk about it because, like, even this past year, I went on a dark ride, the Looney Tunes dark ride in Six Flags over Texas, and just under a year later, it got flooded out and is destroyed. So it's
yeah.
like, how do you save stuff?
Right.
So, anyways, good night, everyone. Well, everybody, hairy thing, Kungaloosh.
Kungaloosh.